I'm inside the belly of a ship that's been built by redundant shipyard workers as the set for one of the biggest events in this European City of Culture year.
It's like a candelabrum glowing, the blossoms that are like flames ascending to the heavens. And it's all very poetic. It's very hard to find the right kind of language in front of paintings like this.
I see making art as an internal journey, which carries me where it carries me. And in a sense, it's only of any use to me if through it I can act out my own internal drama.
The trapeze work is done from a disused Soviet crane which they bought. They get battered cars and do the most extraordinary things with them. One woman drives a mini which is completely filled with water with fish swimming around it.
The wild excess of a French circus is just one of the artistic endeavours encountered by Meridian in 1990. In January, the Theatre Realistica in Prague began rehearsals for the first ever Czech production of Václav Havel's play Redevelopment. Though now leader of his country, Havel was no stranger to political harassment under the old regime, and Redevelopment explores the psychological destruction of people under oppression.
Apples.
Yes. I wondered
One moment.
Excuse me, they're not for you. Why are you cutting them up?
Regulations. There could be a message hidden in one of them. No, all clear.
So, will you let them have them?
If they don't hinder the investigation, they can have them at the proper time.
When's that?
Fruit transmission time.
It was film transmission time in May at the Cannes Film Festival in the south of France. And it was Havel's homeland that provided a treat for critic Derek Malcolm, as he explained to Nick Rankin.
It's been an above-average can, I think. And one of the most astonishing films was a 20-year-old film from Czechoslovakia. It's been banned for 20 years, and it's just being seen now. And it's called The Year by Karol Kacina, a wonderful little film about a party official who goes to a party for the leader, the beloved leader of his country, and finds that the man who's always patronized him has just been fired. And he goes back home after the party with his drunken wife, and the whole night long they worry themselves sick. Their place is bugged, the security people are outside. It's very frightening and also very funny, and I think it's really one of the very best films here.
Derek, what films have been your favourites?
There was one film that was really very entertaining, and I enjoyed it very much indeed, and that's Clint Eastwood's White Hunter, Black Heart. It's actually based on a book about John Huston and the making of The African Queen with Katharine Hepburn and Humphrey Bogart. Well, not really based on the making of the film, but what happened before the making, when John Huston went out to Africa and got obsessed with shooting elephants instead of starting the film.
So Clint Eastwood plays this John Huston?
So Clint Eastwood actually plays John Huston, but he doesn't do a sort of parody of him, or he doesn't try to mimic him. It's a first-class performance in its own right, but I think it's a very good story, even if you've never heard of John Huston, and it's one of the most Shelley entertaining films in the festival. I think Clint Eastwood has a chance of getting Best Actor Award, but whether he will or not, I just don't know.
In the event, the French actor Gérard Depardieu took the prize for his title role in Cyrano de Bergerac. But more about Clint Eastwood's film could be heard in a Meridian interview with Peter Viertel. It was he who wrote the book on which White Hunter, Black Heart is based, and he who worked as a screenwriter with director John Huston on The African Queen back in 1951. Huston had the reputation for being what polite people call difficult.
He had a deadly logic that made it very difficult at times, because he was not what we call, what Billy Wilder used to call an early settler. And so it was rather torture working with him. Because he wasn't full of ideas himself. He was more critical than creative.
You know something, Pete? You're never going to be a good screenwriter, and you know why?
No, John, why don't you tell me why?
Because you let 85 million popcorn eaters pull you this way and that way. To write a movie, you must forget that anyone's ever going to see it.
Well, you're going to make damn sure nobody ever sees this one.
Well, maybe I am. But I figure there's two ways to live in this world. One is you can crawl and kiss ass and never take a chance on anything, never fly, never leave Hollywood. And then when you're a healthy-looking 50, you you die of a stroke because whatever was wild in you has eaten away the muscles of your heart. The other way is to let the chips fall where they may. Refuse to sign their contracts and tell off the guy who can cut your throat and flatter the little guy who's hanging by a thread that you hold.
John, maybe you shouldn't be in the picture business.
In 1990, it wasn't a good idea to be in any business, as the recession took hold. In the London art markets, the autumn sale of modern and impressionist art was a disaster. A Van Gogh picture, owned by actress Elizabeth Taylor, and valued at between £8 and £10 million, was just one of the many works that failed to sell. Van Gogh is probably the best-known painter in the world, and until recently, his pictures commanded the highest prices.
Lot 43. Far, please. 5 million for it. 5 million, 5,500,000, 5,500,000.
The 1987 auctioning of Van Gogh's painting of Sunflowers and the opening scene in Robert Altman's film Vincent and Theo.
Last time, at £22.5 million and £22,500,000 for the last time.
1990 marked the centenary of Van Gogh's death by suicide at the early age of 37. And Altman's film explores the relationship between the tormented and impoverished artist and his art dealer brother, Theo, who loved and supported him.
I want to know what's been going on here when I've been away.
But what is the point of Paris? What is the
whole point of Paris? It's to talk to people, it's to meet people, it's to talk to other artists. I think you'd
better go to bed.
And don't you tell me there's no market for my work. It's your job to make a market. If you can sell coral, you can damn well sell me.
Count me out of that household. As part of the centenary celebrations, nearly 400 of Van Gogh's paintings and drawings went on display in Amsterdam. Art critic Andrew Graham Dixon was at the opening of the exhibition in March. One of Van Gogh's most famous pictures is The Potato Eaters, a somber picture of a group of peasants.
They're almost like caricatures, but they're not quite. They look as if they've almost become the food that they're eating. Their faces look gnarled and potato-like, and it's an incredibly dark painting. It's virtually impossible to make the figures in it out unless you step up fairly close. But there's none of the kind of idealising of the pastoral way of life. It's as if Van Gogh has deliberately tried to make a painting that is as ugly and as impoverished and as dark and bleak as these people's lives. And I think that idea of painting as a vehicle for feeling, as something that adapts to the world rather than tries to make the world better or more pleasant, I think that stays with Van Gogh right to the end.
But the picture that really grabbed Andrew's attention was painted in Arles, southern France, in 1888. One of a series of an orchard covered in glowing pink flowers.
It's fantastic. It's a tribute to nature's amazing fecundity. It's like a candelabrum glowing. The blossoms that are like flames ascending to the heavens. I mean, it's all very poetic. It's very hard to find the right kind of language in front of paintings like this. And yet he's only got 2 years left, so it's corny to say that it's tragic, but I think this exhibition does remind you that it is tragic and that Van Gogh's career really was a career cut short. And then that's one of the strangest things about him, is that he's an artist who really died almost at the moment that he had reached maturity as a painter. And then he's dead, and yet he's probably the most famous artist in the world.
Sadly, one of the most famous actresses in the world died in April.
Correct me if I'm wrong. We are facing north, aren't we?
Facing north? Well, now, I'd hate to commit myself without my compass. Pardon me, are you an explorer?
No, I'm looking for the Eiffel Tower.
Good heavens, is that thing lost again?
Greta Garbo, as a Russian communist in Paris, eventually won over to frivolous Western ways by her co-star Melvin Douglas in the 1939 film Ninotchka. In movies such as Grand Hotel and Queen Christina, the mysterious charisma of this Swedish actress worked its magic on both camera and audiences alike. After the Second World War, she withdrew from acting and the glare of publicity, often misquoted as saying, "I have earned to be alone." But for 50 years, the enigma of Garbo continued, And in a Meridian tribute, Alexander Walker took a look back over her glittering career.
Fame for Garbo wasn't a spur, if the truth be told, it was a drag. Yet the paradox is, in a mere 24 films, she was at least 24 different women, and all of them in love in different moods. If she didn't herself quite believe in love, she certainly put on a good act. Nothing suited Garbo better than romance, except perhaps the leaving of it, in a scene like the last moments of Camille, when death and the arms of Robert Taylor receive her together.
Nanine, get the doctor quickly.
Doctor, if you can't make me live, how can he?
No, don't say such things, Marguerite. You live. You must live.
Perhaps it's better if I live in your heart, where the world can't see me.
Oh, they say my people long ago were looking for a different tune, one that we could croon as only we can. We only had the rhythm, so we started swaying to and fro. We didn't know just what to use, but this is how the blues, I said the blues really began.
Another artist who took leave of us was the American entertainer Sammy Davis Jr., who died in May at the age of 64. He was the man who, when asked at a golf match what his handicap was, replied, "I'm a one-eyed, coloured Jew." Lon Sutton knew and worked with him.
Sammy Davis was one of the most talented performers, live performers, the world has ever known. He would walk on that stage, I mean, a diminutive little figure, and you'd see this little ugly man, short, black, one-eyed. And then after about 5 minutes, he became beautiful. He became magical. He became charismatic, and he absolutely dominated any audience anywhere in the world if it were live. And I'm sure that Sammy Davis would be greatly missed by, well, people all over the world, and especially black people in America.
That was Mr. Bojangles. Mr. Bojangles. Mr. Bojangles. Lord, he could dance.
1990 was the year when the comic book hero Dick Tracy made it onto the big screen, with Warren Beatty and Madonna in the leading roles. The film was accompanied by a fearsome publicity campaign. Hype also announced the emergence of another group of characters from the pages of comic books, as Suzanne Levy discovered in New York.
First a comic book, then a TV cartoon show, and now a major movie. And we're talking major here. It's grossed $90 million so far in the States. Four baby turtles fall into radioactive slime and end up human size, trained in ninja martial arts, okay? And they speak street talk.
Cowabunga, dude.
And they eat pizza. Lots of it. And they're the most popular children's characters since, well, last year, and they've sold over $200 million worth of related merchandise. The turtles, who, by the way, are named
Michelangelo, Donatello, Leonardo, and Raphael,
after Renaissance artists, are also available in miniature size in the shops, along with a range of other products. Or were.
In 2 days, it was here and it was gone. And there was a line, like everybody lined up over here, and they was buying like 5 or 6 at a time because it's so popular.
Hey! Wait for me! Whoa! God, I love being a turtle!
What is their attraction? Cato Hawthorne of Toy Park in New York has had to spend many hours watching little boys go wild over the turtles.
The turtles do give the kids, you know, a chance to follow a hero that is not a human being, so is not plagued with all the faults of a human being. With Superman, the kids did have to deal with Lois Lane. The turtles, you don't have any of that sex thing involved at all. They're just heroes. They just go around, they eat pizza, they fight a lot of bad guys, They speak a cool language, and they never go beyond the understanding of a 7-year-old.
Something beyond the understanding of many people well over the age of 7 was the marriage of football and opera. The big surprise hit in the UK pop charts was the BBC television theme tune for its coverage of the World Cup in Rome. Luciano Pavarotti singing Nessun Dorma, an aria from Puccini's opera Turandot. And Pavarotti joined forces with Placido Domingo and José Carreras in an open-air concert in Rome. The three most famous tenors in the world, singing together, reached an audience of 800 million, courtesy of satellite TV. West Germany may have won the World Cup, but opera stole the show. Staying in Italy, the 44th Venice Biennale began in June. It's a huge international art show in which individual countries exhibit the work of selected artists in national pavilions. The official British representative, the young sculptor Anish Kapoor, carried off the prize for the best artist under 35, which pleased art critic Richard Cork.
This really was rather outstanding, at the risk of sounding chauvinistic. He's actually handled the space very well indeed. You walk into the pavilion and you're confronted immediately by these immense red sandstone boulders, a tremendous statement about weight and mass and volume. And then suddenly, very surprisingly, you realise that each of these boulders has got a tiny black aperture in the top, and you look down into this hole and you realise that within each of these boulders there is an immense void. It's actually called Void Field, this work of art.
He crosses boundaries, doesn't he, because he often uses paint or pigment in his sculptures, but he tends to stay with primary colours, doesn't he? Yellow, red, blue and black.
Yes, he does, and he uses colour in a very subversive way, almost as if he wants to rob sculpture of most of its traditional properties. For example, there's a sculpture in the back room, which is two gigantic lumps of slate, and he's covered them in this extraordinary blue pigment, very, very vivid and iridescent colour, and it has a floating effect. It seems to lift the pieces of slate up off the floor until they seem to hover in space. When I talked to him at the Biennale, he explained why he uses colour in this way.
Pigment is the stuff, in a way, of earth. In quantity, it has a kind of material presence, and yet it's made of nothing. Yet it's ephemera. It seems to me that painting deals with an illusory space, with the space in that sense of the mind, and that sculpture deals with the world. It's here, it's present. I seem to have a curious combination of the two.
There was much talk at Venice of the financial difficulties that seem to be threatening the future of the Biennale, as it's a unique opportunity to see a truly worldwide mixture of artwork. It will be a pity if this exhibition were to disappear from the calendar. One event whose future seems certain is the Edinburgh Festival, which kicked off in August.
We've got the largest festival on our hands that we've ever had, and it's 44-year history. There are 537 companies, 1,100 shows, and by, I think, the morning of the 2nd of September, when the Fringe closes, we estimate that there will have been 9,800 performances given. This should be celebrated.
They're off, the 44th Edinburgh International Festival. Musicians, actors, dancers, writers, readers and filmmakers from America, Africa and Australia, the Pacific Rim and the heart of Europe. 3 weeks of performances, plays and paintings. But where to start? For me, it's the circus. Only this isn't like any other circus. This is the French circus, Archaos.
They're taking the idea of circus, which is a very old one, to new heights or depths, depending on how you look at it.
Douglas Fraser from the Scotsman newspaper.
The trapeze work is done from a disused Soviet crane which they bought. They get battered cars and do the most extraordinary things with them. There are chainsaws, oxyacetylene torches, there are people banging torches against drums. Everybody's doing something on stage at that time. That is the real sort of explosion. It's the idea of the urban jungle just detonating.
As ever at the festival, there was an interesting array of new drama on show. At the Traverse Theatre was a South African play, Curl Up and Die. Curl Up and Die, that's D-Y-E, is the name of a hairdressing salon in a Johannesburg suburb, a so-called grey area, where newly arrived blacks are moving in alongside whites. The play was written by and starred Susan Pam.
The play is set in a hairdressing salon which has gone down. It's fallen behind the times and it's had to take in black customers to keep itself going. The hairdressing salon, Curl Up and Die, acts as a microcosm of the grey area.
Rowlene, a flat in my block is coming vacant at the end of this month. Now keep this between me, you and the lamppost. You're the first person I'm telling, because I would very much like you and your husband to have first option on it. We got excellent security. A gate with a boy, it's cheap, and we are serviced, my girl. My main thing is to keep the block white, pure. You know what I mean?
Your flat's white and pure. Ach, please don't make me laugh.
This is a private conversation.
And cheap, and I'll tell you why they're cheap.
Now listen here.
No, you listen here. Your flats are dirt cheap because all you can get is low-class white rubbish who are too lazy to work.
Excuse me. Who the hell are you to talk about my block like that?
Curl Up and Die very much caught the attention of theatre critic Michael Billington.
What I think Susan Pam, who incidentally gives a very good performance herself as Jolene, who runs the salon, what the play really says is that all the problems in these areas to do with drugs, prostitution, lawlessness, crime, violence, are not the consequence of the blacks moving in. They are problems that were there long ago. And what they stem from is the existence of a white underclass that is, in many cases, very ill-educated and ill-equipped. I think the play manages to say a lot in a short compass. It's not offering remedies, it's not offering solutions, it's just saying the whites have to sort out their own problems before they start to adopt lofty, condescending or arrogant attitudes towards the blacks.
October saw the spotlight fall on writers, as two major awards were announced. The Nobel Prize for Literature went to a Mexican.
En la montaña negra, el torrente de lira en voz alta. A esa misma hora, tú avanzas entre precipicios por tu cuerpo dormido.
Octavio Paz, reading one of his poems. This diplomat, translator, critic, essayist and poet has been hailed by the novelist Carlos Fuentes as the greatest living Mexican writer. Over the years, he's travelled a great deal, and this has strengthened his work, according to Jason Wilson, the author of two books on Paz.
Latin American culture is cosmopolitan anyhow, but Paz has added to that by actually travelling, particularly to the Far East. It was particularly in India that Paz lived from 1962 to 68, where he was ambassador, and it was through Indian religions, Buddhism and Hinduism, that Paz was able to look at, for instance, the religious needs of all human beings and compare that with Catholicism and Christianity and what it meant to be a Mexican with the pre-Columbian Aztec gods, the imposition of Catholicism and so on. So it gave him a sort of relative view of what he's almost called a hunger for meaning through religions.
The Booker Prize for Fiction is Britain's most important literary award. After months of media speculation, the six shortlisted authors attend a dinner at London's Guildhall, a glamorous occasion where the whole of the English publishing profession gather together. Meridian came live from the Guildhall as the tension mounted.
The winner is A.S. Byatt, Possession.
And so Antonia Byatt got £20,000 in prize money, plus the vastly increased sales that winning the Booker guarantees. Christopher Cook managed to talk with the author just after her award was announced.
Antonia, were you surprised that you were the winner this year?
Yes, I was very surprised. I had completely persuaded myself that I wasn't going to win.
You made a splendid short speech, but you didn't tell us what you're actually going to do with the £20,000 cheque. Have you got a plan for it?
I have a plan. I have a small house in France where I write. And what I want to do is build a small swimming pool in which I can swim up and down, because I never get any exercise, because writing is a sedentary occupation. And in this way, I shall live longer and write more books.
It's been a very public year for you. I mean, the book has won other prizes. Has that sense of publicity on you as a writer made life a little more difficult than you would wish it to be?
Yes, I have enjoyed it. It's nice to feel successful. I'm very glad that people are reading the book so much. I like the feeling of being read by many people. But I also feel, I think all writers must, that I would like to go away now and write something quietly by myself.
It was anything but quiet at the opening of a new play, called The Ship, in Glasgow, which throughout the year was European City of Culture. Alison Bell went to a former engine shed on the River Clyde.
Britain's best-known theatre directors and himself a Clydesider, wrote The Ship as a celebration of a river and its people. It's the story of a community in the 1950s who are coming to terms with the fact that the cruise liner they're building could be their last. Bill Bryden and one of his cast, Jimmy Logan, explain what it's all about.
It seemed to be very appropriate to celebrate the history and the energy and humour, if you like, of these craftspeople, and the riveters, the welders, the joiners who built the great ships. And I think there was something glorious about the past of the Clyde Bank and government elsewhere.
This production tells more than anything the story of shipbuilding and the loss of shipbuilding on the River Clyde from the working man's point of view. This is the story as seen through the eyes of the men who didn't have control of their future but were there to build the ships. They were artists in a way.
Panic. The ship has claimed the life of a worker. And as the launch approaches, there's fear of the future among the young men. The older ones can afford to be philosophical.
Everything perfect, bang on time. I like it when things are just so. I get worried when things get out of kilter.
The river will do what she likes.
Aye she will.
I wonder if she knows that what she stands for is at an end. I wonder if she knows she's dying.
This production of The Ship ends with the launch, a fantastic illusion as the entire outer casing of the set slips away into the mist. Perhaps the last word goes to the audience, who on the first night at least were predominantly Glasgow people themselves.
When a ship goes, you still get a lump in the throat. And we've seen it umpteen times.
I thought it was absolutely tremendous. It's possibly the highlight of the year so far. It's just quite incredible, the whole thing. When the ship went down, you physically felt yourself going with it. It wasn't your body, it was your heart that went with it.
And that ends this review of 1990. As Meridian prepares to launch into the new year, I hope you'll join us.